Okay, the presidential campaign can start now.
Okay, yeah, I know.
But seriously, it's general election time, finally! And that means this is a good time to think about our institutions, political and otherwise. Parties, countries, identities. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. This week, we are continuing our conversation about insiders and outsiders. Who gets to make a decision in a political party, in an economy? We're bringing you coverage of the U.S. election and the fallout from the Brexit vote across Europe. We've even got a story from an outsider who helped create her own institution, an Olympic swimmer on the first ever team comprised of refugees. As always, come share your thoughts with us at Marketplace.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We're starting the week off with our segment Long and Short. That's when we make some bets on or against things in the news, but do it using the language of finance. And this week, we bring you another special convention-themed edition. We have Marketplace's DC reporter, Kimberly Adams, and 538's politics editor, Micah Cohen. Kimberly and Micah have been in Philadelphia this past week covering the Democratic National Convention. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Lizzie.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Kimberly, why don't you go first and tell us what you are long as we head into this general election season?
I am going to go long on WikiLeaks and the Democratic National Committee. This was a huge story all week long. These leaked emails supposedly perpetrated by Russian hackers that show that the Democratic National Committee was biased in their support of Hillary Clinton and sought to undermine the Sanders campaign. And then we heard just towards the end of this week that there was potentially another hack of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which raises money for House races. And there's just so much information here. And the Bernie supporters in particular were just furious about this. And even though Bernie Sanders has encouraged his supporters to back Hillary Clinton, I think this story and what we find out about the way that this particular committee raised money and worked with these campaigns is going to be a story for a while yet.
Yeah. Do you guys think that this kind of keeps going on through the general election in a way that resonates with, you know, everybody as opposed to just the sort of party insiders?
I think that it's really going to come up a lot when we start seeing attack ads from the Republican Party, from Donald Trump, going after Hillary. She's already struggling with this issue of trustworthiness. And I have to imagine that the Republicans are going to be using this as another tool to demonstrate that they believe that Hillary Clinton can't be trusted.
Micah, what do you think? This sort of, this isn't an October surprise. I guess we can call it, a July and August surprise to have this internal stuff kind of out in the public eye. But does it matter to voters, do you think?
Well, I think that's an open question. To me, the main, determining factor will be, do voters see this as what they suspected all along? You know, for me personally, covering the campaign, when I saw these emails, I thought, of course, this is what they were doing. This is kind of almost the job of a party boss. Will voters see it that way? I think it's, that's less likely, but I'm not sure we know that they'll see it as, this sort of sneaking behind people's backs to undermine the electorate more than just kind of like, oh, that's politics as usual. One thing I think is right about going long on this is, I wonder if this is going to become just now the new normal, a permanent feature of politics where, there are these hacks and kind of these what used to be confined to smoke-filled rooms is now all over the internet. People generally don't like seeing how the sausage is made, but this is a brave new world.
Micah, why don't you tell us what you're long?
So right now, for this moment, I'm going to go long on Hillary Clinton's poll numbers. And by poll numbers, I mean her support in horse race polls against Donald Trump and her favorability numbers among voters overall. We're at this moment now where Trump has received his convention bounce. It wasn't a huge bounce by historical standards. It was actually fairly normal, 3 to 4 percentage points. And now we're going to have to wait to see if Clinton gets her bounce in return. The Democratic convention started off a bit rocky, but I think you'll likely see, and this historically is what conventions are for, Democrats rallying behind Clinton. So some of Clinton's softness in the polls is from Democrats, particularly Sanders supporters. So I think you'll see some of that, maybe not all Sanders supporters, but some Sanders supporters get aboard. And I also just think, you know, we just got 4 days of people singing Clinton's praises. That historically has had an effect on candidates' favorability. So I think, you know, in a week, in 2 weeks, will likely be, you know, I may regret saying this, but Clinton will likely be back up a couple, you know, 3-4 percentage points. Historically, it could be even bigger than that, but let's say at least 3 points, and we'll have a much better sense for kind of the equilibrium of the race.
I feel like, Kimberly, that your short kind of knits in nicely here with Micah's long.
Right. I'm going short on the Bernie bros. These are the guys who got a lot of attention during the campaign for being just such strong, strong Bernie supporters that perhaps that many of them took it a little bit too far in terms of really going after a lot of the women who were supporters of Hillary Clinton and other groups, and in a way that was quite disparaging, and they were not so affectionately termed Bernie bros. And the reason I'm going short on them in particular is because there was this group of Bernie supporters at the convention that were just so hardcore. They were never Hillary. There were even some people who were saying that they, you know, were seeking to undermine Hillary Clinton's campaign, and they thought that it was all rigged. It was interesting the last night of the convention to hear how many times that these anti-Hillary chants got shouted down by people shouting Hillary over them and quieting them, and how many people that I talked to who arrived supporters of Bernie, left still supporters of Bernie, but willing to support Hillary. And then, of course, there was that moment when Sarah Silverman, the comedian, was up on stage and said, "For all of you that are Bernie or bust, you're being ridiculous." And I think that some of the wind is being taken out of the sails of some of the angrier parts of that group.
Well, what happens to those guys now? I mean, do they go away? Do they vote for Trump? Do they not vote?
I think most Bernie supporters will vote for Clinton. I think what you saw at the convention was, frankly, a small minority of really hardcore Bernie supporters. And I agree, it sort of really didn't play that well in the hall. They were kind of the skunks at the garden party. Right now, the polls are showing, you know, a good chunk voting third party or saying they're going to vote third party for either Gary Johnson or Jill Stein. Historically, you know, support for third-party candidates tends to go down as the election progresses. Sanders brought a lot of young voters and a lot of voters who hadn't participated in previous elections into the process. So those voters who are less connected to the process are more likely to sort of take their ball and go home now that Sanders hasn't won the nomination.
I want you then, Micah, to give us your short, because I think it works with this idea of who's a big part of the process, who's not, and whether we're in some wholesale reevaluation of U.S. politics right now.
Yeah, I think we are, and I'm going short the Republican Party. And
that is a that's quite a bet, my friend.
That's a big short.
this is a bet that may take a long time to pay off. And I, by short the Republican Party, I don't mean that the Republican Party will implode and in 4 years we'll have, you know, the Democratic Party versus the, you know, the Green Party, and those will be the two major parties. But what I mean is the Republican Party is now led by a candidate who does not stand for issues that the Republican Party has traditionally stood for. And Trump, you know, is the sort of culmination of long-term trends in the GOP. The Republican Party has gotten whiter, older, and less educated as the country overall has gotten more diverse, younger, and better educated. And so as the GOP sort of splinters from the country overall, they're having a real tough time winning elections, winning national elections. The other part of this, though, isn't just electorally. It's, you know, the point of a party is to articulate policy and ideas. And it's really not clear anymore what the Republican Party stands for.
I mean, one part of this was, you know, after the big Tea Party sweep in the House a couple of years back, we saw the Republicans really trying to, at least the Republican establishment, really trying to organize and say, you know, we can't be the party of anti-everything, and we have to get ourselves together and do outreach and come up with a way to reach out to younger and minority voters. And they did that. They did that outreach. And now, in this election, you see a lot of that just kind of falling apart, as Micah mentioned, sort of this Republican Party kind of fracturing. The third parties are getting a lot more attention. And one of the things I've been wondering is whether or not this election is going to be the one we look back on to say this is where third parties in America really started gaining traction. But who knows?
I think that's absolutely right. You know, for a couple of decades now, we've been able to put everything in politics on a left-right spectrum. But if you look at, you know, through the whole course of American history, that's actually pretty unusual. And I think now you're seeing the second spectrum develop, insider-outsider, right? Where Clinton and Sanders actually agreed on 95% of things, but Bernie was an outsider and Clinton was an insider. And this isn't limited to the U.S., but I would definitely think this new spectrum is going to be really determinative going forward. And you'll see a lot of candidates claiming to be an outsider and a lot of genuine outsiders running. And I think that's right, that, you know, third parties might do unusually well this year.
And that's one of the reasons why we were doing our podcast the past couple of weeks that we called Politics Inside Out, because people felt exactly as Micah said, that it didn't really matter if they were left wing or right wing or Republican or Democrat. What mattered to most of the people we talked to is that they felt like they were just outside the system.
Marketplace's Kimberly Adams, 538's Micah Cohen. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thank you.
And you can listen to Marketplace's special pop-up podcast, Politics Inside Out, wherever you get your podcasts. We're obviously pretty into the numbers here at Marketplace, which is why every week we take a look at some of the biggest stories in the news by the numbers. Here are Marketplace producers Tony Wagner and Eliza Mills with this week's numbers. Hit it, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
121 million.
That's how many incidents of drunk driving there are every year, according to a new study in the American Journal of Epidemiology.
Uber has claimed for years that its arrival in cities reduces drunk driving, but research has found there's no connection.
Ride-sharing might feel big to people who've grown to count on it, and it could put a dent in DUIs eventually, but right now they just don't have the drivers.
$1 trillion.
That's the nationwide funding gap for pensions of cops, teachers, and other public employees.
Compounding the problem, those funds are still recovering from the recession.
20-year yields are at 7.5% for 2016, a 15-year low.
1 billion.
That's how many iPhones Apple has sold.
And how many people use Facebook every single day.
Both companies announced those milestones at their earnings calls, and they're both kind of blowing our minds.
Honestly, I think I've cracked a billion iPhone screens.
I think I have a billion Farmville requests, like, just from my aunt.
When you hear the phrase work-life balance, do you roll your eyes? It's one of those things that we talk so much about in our culture, in part because people have trouble finding it. And this week, we asked you to tell us about your own work-life balance, or lack thereof. Amy Scrivener wrote to us on Facebook. She says it's a constant struggle. She lives in Cincinnati, and she's been working in nonprofits for nearly 20 years.
For nonprofit workers, there is definitely a sense of guilt if we don't feel like we're giving 110%. We're tackling some really important issues and helping very vulnerable populations.
Are there things you've done to try to sort of change that balance or give yourself a mental break?
I have, and it's taken a long time. I've, again, done this work for 20 years, and I will be the first to admit that I don't do vacation very well. I have a very supportive husband who requires me to turn off my phone. I get my work email on my phone. He is a constant reminder that life will go on at work without me, and that if I've done my job well as a supervisor, that my staff can carry on. And I'm constantly telling my staff that I set a very poor example of work-life balance and that they should do what I say, not necessarily what I do.
Do you think this is specific to nonprofits? You know, if you worked in a corporate job, do you think you'd still have this issue?
I think it applies across the board. I think there are some nuances within the nonprofit world. And some of it takes on economic questions. You know, some of our most stressed nonprofit workers are the people who make the least, and they're least likely to splurge on a massage or do so-called self-care. They simply can't afford to do it. In the for-profit world, and my friends who are in the for-profit world, they have perks at work. They can get on-site massages. There are budget items that sort of allow for them to de-stress or take care of themselves. And we don't necessarily have that in the nonprofit world.
Amy Scrivener, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
For Brian Krylowitz, it wasn't so much about struggling to find balance as it was to kind of abandon the idea of balance altogether. Brian's the director of counseling at a small college in Massachusetts, and he says things got better when he learned to integrate his work into his life.
I tried for years of trying to go, how do I balance my life? And I realized I couldn't do it very well. And so I just made my life kind of all blend together. I work at a college where it's a little bit easier. But, you know, my daughter's on campus, and, you know, there's times I'm doing stuff at home, and there's times that I just kind of integrate stuff, so or my family kind of works with me.
Does it feel like your work is interrupting your life, or does it not even feel that way anymore?
Yes and no. Great question. At times it does. I think, you know, one of the stories I say is, you know, my phone rings at home, and my daughter will say, is this someone at work that needs you? Well, at one level, that can be very, like, sad.
Yeah.
The other part is my daughter also knows that, you know, I can find a way to make it work for her at other times. And so we try to make it work together. So there is a loss, but there's also a gain because, you know, I think, you know, she knows about my life and we talk openly about college and psychological problems. And, it, you know, it's kind of weird, but it works for me.
Do you think that the idea of work-life balance is unrealistic or false in some way?
No, I mean, I, you know, now you're talking, I'm kind of been turned into a therapist now. And then, no, I mean, I think it depends on who the person is in their life, what they have. I mean, and I have a lot of friends that are incredibly good about boundaries and keeping things separate and not checking emails at home. It didn't match my personality. It didn't match the life that I had. So, I mean, I don't think it's a falsehood. I think I just got tired of being mad at myself for not being good at it. So I just kind of, I didn't give up on it. I just changed, you know, I moved the goalpost.
What was the internal conversation you had with yourself when you decided to shift from this idea of balance to integration?
I think it was the idea of, you know, I mean, it came down to, like, why can't I get home on time? You know, why am I having to run off? And I think it was kind of an internal rage, you know, and I think when I talk to my wife and I talk to my daughter and they're like, you're just being you, you know, we're okay with it. And so I realized it was much more my own frustration. And again, if my family was different, if I worked in a different work environment, this may not work. But, you know, I work at a very family-friendly college that incorporates that, yeah, bring your kids up. You know, it's okay. And so I make it work. But I think when it's flipped over for me, I just, you know, when Sandy is doing the same thing over and over, hoping for different results. And so I just changed what I was doing.
Brian Krylowitz, thank you so much.
You're more than welcome.
Ricky Garcia changed careers to make himself feel more balanced. He lives in Idaho and has a new job that gives him more flexibility, unlike his old one.
I worked at a bank as an online service specialist, and I realized I wasn't really doing the things that I wanted to. It was draining, and to the point where I worked 30 hours, but I was still exhausted. So I actually took a leap of faith, quit that, and learned web development over 5 months through a program that teaches you how to make websites. But during that time, I learned how to market myself and really learned about social media, and that's how I got this job, where I'm much more passionate. I can stay sometimes, you know, 12 hours, and I don't have the same feelings that I used to. But it's really flexible, where I can come in at like 7 in the morning and stay until 3, or I can come in at 9 and stay until 5. It really depends on my clients and just getting the work done, being really flexible, but also taking accountability for your work.
Well, what does the idea of work-life balance mean to you anyway?
For me, it's where you can blend work and life together and not have it feel like, oh, I got to go to work, or, oh, I need a vacation. You know, getting to that point where work and life are in balance as far as, like, goals are aligned. So I may only work 35 to 40 hours a week, but on my free time, I go ahead and make sure to learn how to improve myself because I genuinely take an interest in this. It's not something that I feel like, oh, the man is keeping me down or anything like that.
Well, Ricky Garcia, thank you so much for talking with us.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks to everyone who called, tweeted, and wrote to us on Facebook. We want to keep this conversation going over the next few weeks. So come tell us how you balance your personal time with work, or don't. For me, personally, I sometimes find a big story makes me just as excited as a vacation. Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, search for Marketplace Business News, or you can call us 1-800-648-5114. Not long after the Brexit vote, a truck with a billboard on its side started driving around London with the message, "Dear startups, keep calm and move to Berlin." It was sponsored by a German political party trying to get companies based in the UK to shift their operations to Germany. Yes, recent attacks there may have spooked some businesses, but capitalism does tend to march on. And right now, companies don't really know whether being based in Britain is going to let them have access to the European single market. So Germany, and to some extent France, are trying to pull off what you might call economic land grabs, wooing companies and people who, but for Brexit, would be in the UK. I recently went to Berlin to learn more. To successfully pull off an economic land grab, you basically need two things: jobs and people.
Tell me where we are. We're like standing in this giant courtyard here. Where are we?
Of course, we're right in the center of Berlin in Mitte.
A place where Simon Schaefer is trying to create hundreds of jobs. He's the founder and CEO of Factory, which is sort of a tech accelerator, co-working space, and startup network rolled into one.
We dub it Silicon LA.
Of course you do.
Yeah, of course we do.
And we're walking across the street from his office here in the Mitte district of Berlin to a new building that his company is renovating.
This left side will be a coffee shop dash beer bar. And on first floor, it's office space for a larger tech company. Second floor will be co-working.
The third and fourth floor are already bustling. The social network for scientists is in that space already. And on top, apartments for people who are going to want to live in this little hive of tech activity. We go up to a balcony overlooking the city. And Schaefer, who advises the European Commission on technology issues, is feeling pretty good about Germany's position in the tech world right now.
So you must have watched the Brexit vote with a little bit of, is it exaggerating to say Schadenfreude?
Not at all. I think Schadenfreude is an interesting term for that. Both my sisters live in London, so I feel a little bit of pity too, but it's very obvious. You know, all the things that are going for unified Europe from an entrepreneurship perspective, right? If you look at every single piece of legislation that is focusing on growth in Europe, it's usually about the digital space and how to unify that across borders and how to be competitive against the superpowers in the internet, China and USA.
he thinks, and yes, of course, it's in his interest to say so, that startups will come to Berlin, to Paris, to any place where they have access to the European single market. That's something that a British-based company can't guarantee without EU membership. That means a lot of places are trying to lure business right now. A financial lobbying group in Frankfurt has been promoting the city to foreign banks. The French prime minister said he wants Paris to be the center of finance in Europe. One thing that could stand in the way? Taxes. Germany's corporate tax rate is roughly 30%. France, 33%. Britain, only 20%. And then there is that other thing you need to make your land grab a success. People. Thousands of people, most of them young, lined up by the Brandenburg Gate to watch Germany play France in soccer in the Euro Cup semifinals recently. And it was a bit like a small European Union. People from Germany, France, Belgium, Portugal, and yes, the UK. Like this guy, Ben Dow.
My name is Ben. I'm 29, and I'm working and studying here.
Before the Brexit vote, he was planning on going back to the UK. But now?
I'll stay here. Yeah. Well, I'll apply for a German passport and I'll stay.
Remember, his generation has known nothing but a united Europe, where they can work, study, and travel anywhere within its boundaries. And that's something that Germans want to keep.
We have more than 90% backing this idea of having an integrated Europe.
Peter Matuszek is one of the most accurate pollsters in Germany. He says Germans see Brexit as Britain's loss, not theirs. Matuszek also found that Germany's Eurosceptic Party, the AfD, lost support, while Angela Merkel's party gained it.
Brexit had an effect on voters in Germany insofar as they rallied around the governing parties, especially the Christian Democrats.
And that means that a policy of open borders and open doors for people and companies is pretty much here to stay in Germany. So that's how Germans are looking to potentially gain from the Brexit. But we wondered about the other big player in continental Europe, France. So we asked reporter Emma Jacobs to find out.
On the ground floor of the Parisian co-working space called Numa, every chair is occupied by someone with a laptop. Some days people sit on the floor, says Frederic Auroux, the center's international director.
Usually at 9 o'clock when we open in the morning, people are queuing.
Located close to the center of the city, Numa is one of the hubs of Paris's startup scene. That tech scene has matured and grown and is attracting international talent. Auroux can see this in the applications for the accelerator program for startups.
Out of this 2,000 applications, 20% comes from international, from abroad, and it's increasing definitely.
Given all of this, there has, of course, been some conversation about what Brexit could mean for the local tech scene, as well as the financial sector. But France has some things to overcome, including a reputation for high taxes. That reputation led former Prime Minister David Cameron to joke after one new tax proposal a few years ago that maybe French people would like to come to England.
We will roll out the red carpet and welcome more French businesses to Britain, and they can pay taxes in Britain.
Now, people like Marc Fournier say France has an opportunity to lure businesses in the other direction.
So I think there's a good communications program that needs to be put in place.
Fournier is a managing partner at venture firm Serena Capital in Paris and teaches entrepreneurship at a business school here, ESCP Europe.
I'm sit on boards in London, and all of the investors in London are now curious into finding out what's happening in continental Europe.
French politicians have made it clear they think Paris should be a strong competitor for any business activity leaving London. Welcome to Paris, was the message from Prime Minister Manuel Valls earlier this month.
Bienvenue à Paris. Bienvenue en France. Welcome.
He announced the government would set up a one-stop office to smooth the way for relocating employees. It will go as far as helping people find schools for their kids. The head of the Paris region has sent out letters to thousands of individual executives in Britain. Fournier approves, but says there will need to be more than statements from politicians.
Politicians will get the press coverage. Good French And successful entrepreneurs in Paris need to communicate on all the strengths that are here in Paris.
That's perhaps easier said than done, according to Josephine Goub. She's French but lives in London, where she works for the cross-European tech recruitment site, YBorder. She also advises the European Commission.
Certain companies see this as an opportunity, but they don't want to appear as opportunistic and calling up people in difficulty.
She says France will be a contender, but ultimately, people who do decide to relocate will make the decision for themselves based on all sorts of personal reasons, like language and cultural ties. And, she cautions, there may not be as many jobs up for grabs as people thought right after the Brexit vote. At least, not yet.
I think now that the dust has settled, people are just a little bit more rational and really looking at ways they can relocate or not.
One consideration for people looking at Paris, it's expensive. But back at the co-working space Numa, Oru says that for companies, the engineering talent could be worth the cost, and new entrepreneurs, he jokes, don't need a whole lot.
Basically, noodles and a bed to sleep.
He also thinks it will take time to see how many companies eventually do cross the English Channel. Give it a year, he says, give European countries time to work out their new rules, then we'll see. In Paris, I'm Emma Jacobs for Marketplace.
No matter who you are, you probably had a rough day at the office that changed your perspective on things. Or maybe you made an impulse purchase you really, really wish you could take back. This week, our producer Raghu Manavalan sat down with a guy whose work I guarantee you know. That picture of a little boy reaching out to feel President Obama's hair? He took it.
My name is Pete Souza. I'm the chief official White House photographer for President Obama.
So first question, fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you.
Money can buy you all the camera equipment you need after January 20th.
Why January 20th?
Because that's the day I leave my current job.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
I think the hardest part about my job is that I have not much of a personal life. It's very difficult on my family, kind of on call all the time. I mean, I'm pretty much with him all day long until he goes up to the residence for dinner. And then on weekends, it just kind of depends on what's going on, what's happening in the world. You know, I have this BlackBerry with me 24/7, and I'm looking forward to not having that with me after January 20th. I think that will be quite a relief.
What was your first job?
My first job was being a paper boy for the New Bedford Standard Times in Massachusetts. I think I was 10 or 11, and I did that for a couple years until we moved to a different house, and somebody else already had the paper route.
In the next life, what would your career be?
Well, that's a good question. My job would be a record producer. I'd like to be in the studio with musicians and tell them, oh, add a little bass here and add some more drums here. I just think it'd be a fun job to do.
I feel like that's very similar to your current job. Like you're kind of a fly on the wall, but you're still having some sort of creative input in what's happening.
Except there is no loud music playing, which it's oftentimes very quiet.
When did you realize you can make an actual living off of photography?
Probably not until I actually started doing it. I mean, I had gone to Boston University with the hopes of becoming a sports writer. And in my junior year, I took a photography class. And, you know, right away, I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I remember telling my mother, I came home from school one weekend, and I told her, I'm going to be a photographer now. And she was like, how are you going to make money? And I, you know, somehow it's kind of worked out.
Do you remember your first day on the job?
First day on the job was at a small newspaper in Kansas called the Hutchinson News. And I just remember being really excited to finally being paid every day to take photographs. I thought that was the coolest thing.
What is your most prized possession?
I'm going to cheat and give two answers. One, my wedding ring. It signifies the relationship I have with my wife, and it's, you know, on my hand. It's the only thing I wear. I don't wear a watch or anything else, but I wear that wedding ring every day. But another really cool possession I have is on Air Force One, they serve you lunch on a cafeteria-style tray. And it's like a really cool tray. It has a presidential seal on it. It says Air Force One on it. So it's like not your average cafeteria tray, but it kind of looks like that. And one day they brought me my lunch on this tray, you know, the plates in the middle. And they usually take the tray away when you're done eating lunch. And on this day they came, when I finished lunch, they only took the plate away. And I looked at the tray, and they had made a special tray for me, and it said, congratulations, Pete Souza, on your 1,000th flight on Air Force One. So I have this little book stand in my office at the White House. I would change the photography book on top of the book stand. But since I've gotten this tray, it's been there ever since. It's a pretty cool thing to have.
What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started your career?
I think I wish somebody had said to me, chill out, tomorrow will be okay. You know, don't worry about things that go wrong, because tomorrow's another day and things are going to go right.
The Summer Olympics kick off next weekend in Rio. Tens of thousands of people will be there to watch. As always, that means a heavy security presence. But this year, there's a new tech element. We're talking about giant balloons with super powerful cameras watching the whole city from above. Rio invested $8 million in this security system, called Samara, from Logos Technologies. It'll be the first time that this technology, typically reserved for the military, is rolled out for a big civilian event. Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, spoke with John Marion, the president of Logos. Here he is explaining how Samara works.
The product is similar to a view from Google Earth, essentially zoomed in all the way. But we're taking three images a second of a city-sized area. And then we're also storing all of that so that you can DVR back into the image. So unlike a regular video camera where you only can see what you're pointing at through what we call a soda straw view, with Samara, you're seeing a whole panoramic view of an entire city-sized area. So the sensor itself hangs from a aerostat, which is essentially a blimp that's tethered to the ground. The system that we designed for Brazil, which is Samara, flies at about 1,000 feet. That's the design altitude, and can see out several kilometers all around.
A lot of your company's work has been directly with defense departments and used for military operations. What are the differences as you apply this kind of technology to a large-scale civilian event?
The main difference from a technology standpoint is that Samara uses visible cameras and no IR cameras. So its main capability is during the day, although when there's streetlights and things like that, you can still see some things at night. So that's the primary technological difference. It's quite a bit lighter, so it can fly on a much smaller balloon. And then I think the focus is on, you know, I'm basically preventing bad things from happening right in the area under the balloon, whereas in the military operations, they're typically looking well outside of the base and providing security outside the base.
Are the patterns of civilian movement as easy to read? Are the insights as good?
We don't know yet, because <Yeah. laughs> this is the first try for us as well. I imagine it's very intuitive. It's basically just imagery. For instance, when we were working with the Border Patrol on the Arizona-Mexico border, you know, the first night they watched us use it for about an hour, and then one of the agents just tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Hey, buddy, do you mind if I do it?" And from then on, they were just, you know, they were operating it.
Well, yeah. So how important of a test is this for your company? It's the first time a non-U.S. government entity has operated a wide area motion imagery sensor.
That's right.
It's a move into, you know, civilian surveillance, I guess, for lack of a better term. How closely will you be watching the performance of the system?
Well, I'm going to log on to Google every day and see if I can see the if they've updated, if there's an aerostat flying at any of the four sites. And, of course, I'll be in daily contact with a guy that we have there. So I'm excited to see how it works. And I am, we're all hoping that nothing exciting happens.
Well, yeah. But as you move forward, the Rio contract was worth about $8 million. Is Logos planning to do other non-military security work? And does that hinge somewhat on the outcome of this test?
Yeah, I think it probably does, because if we can show that there is a lot of utility, then I think it will likely lead to other work. Beyond event security, there's also things like disaster relief that, you know, a widespread hurricane or flood damage, you know, we can put this up and keep track of where people are and, you know, where water is and where things need to, you know, supplies need to go and people need to go. And we've also actually been in contact with folks that are trying to protect the megafauna, the big animals in parks in Africa from poachers. So I think there are a number of applications beyond the kind of obvious defense-related security ones.
There are, of course, privacy questions that get raised anytime you're talking about aerial surveillance.
That's right.
How do you see this kind of security moving forward in the U.S. in particular, where a lot of it is not totally legal yet?
It's hard to tell where that's going to come down. You know, obviously, we're not even likely involved in the conversation, because like any law enforcement tool, you know, the various factions will need to establish rules for using this, just like wiretaps or any other tool that the law enforcement has at their disposal. So I think it's a little early to see where that's going to go. And I appreciate the privacy concerns. And then there's also the good things that can happen.
You know, not to stoke the privacy concerns, but how good is this technology? How precise are the images that are coming from the ground? And how close are you to, you know, facial recognition on the ground?
We're miles away from facial recognition, Molly. The facial recognition, you need tens of pixels between your eyes, and we can't resolve your face or a license plate. We're nowhere near actually resolving faces or license plates. So this is not a very good entity detection system.
Right.
This is a way to track things.
But you could track sort of an individual person walking around or a vehicle?
Yep, we can, in fact, do that.
So just as a follow-up, how could the Samara system work, if at all, with other security systems on the ground? Like, is there software that could tie it into a CCTV camera so that if you spot a movement, you could, you know, alert a camera on the ground to zoom in? What level of integration might there be?
Yeah, that's pretty easy to do. In fact, in the deployed systems, they're typically coupled with a video system, and so we can cue back and forth one to the other.
It sounds so, I thought it was sounding like a movie, and you're like, oh, it's pretty easy.
Yeah, it's, not all of it's easy, but cross-queuing is not very hard.
John Marion is the president of Logos Technologies. Thanks for your time.
Nice to talk to you.
Next week, Molly guest hosts the show as we bring you our Marketplace Weekend Olympics special. We'll take a look at the economics of the Rio Games, some of the big issues being raised, like sustainable water, and Olympic gymnast Sam Mikulik takes the Marketplace quiz. There's one team at the Olympics that isn't about representing a specific country. It's a team of refugees. It has 10 members, 5 from South Sudan, 2 from Syria, 2 from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and 1 from Ethiopia. 18-year-old swimmer Yusra Mardini left her home in Syria along with her sister Sarah in August of last year. She now lives and trains in Germany. She took a break from training to tell our partners at the BBC how swimming saved her life.
My name is Yusra Mardini, and I am 18 years old. I'm a swimmer, and my best stroke is fly. I left Syria at 12th of August last year. Sometimes there was a bombing or something like that, or the streets are like dangerous. So sometimes we couldn't train, and sometimes, yeah, we can arrive to the swimming pool, but we can't swim because the water is really cold. This was like as a torturing, you know, because you can't see the water, but you can't train, you know. And you know that other people are training so hard and, yeah, arriving to Olympics, arriving to world championships, and you can't just look and say, yeah, I can't do anything about my situation. Everyone was like, couldn't take it anymore. So after that, we decided, me and my sister, to travel. I traveled from Damascus to Beirut, from Beirut to Turkey, from Turkey with a boat to Greece, from Greece to Macedonia, from Macedonia to Serbia, from Serbia to Hungary, from Hungary to Vienna, from Vienna to Munich, and then to Berlin. Of course, we were scared, but we had to try, like, it's the same. Maybe I'm gonna die on the way, but I'm almost dead in my country. You know, can't do anything. So actually, some friend told us that, okay, this man is good with the boat and blah blah blah. And then, yeah, we trust him and we tried that. We stayed 4 days in the jungles, and the smugglers was always, yeah, I'm gonna get you in the boat, I'm gonna get you in the boat. And we were like 4 days in jungles, no water, no food. And if the boys want to bring us water, they had to go to climb the mountains. And there's police, but the police can't come in because they know that the smugglers have weapons. So they can't come in. And then we started the journey. After like 15 or 30 minutes, the motor stopped. The friend of my dad was with us, and he said, okay, you will do the GPS, and you will like call the police. You will maybe someone have to go to the water. You have to empty the water from the boat. Yeah, and we helped, all of us were together. And then they said someone have to go to the water. My sister jumped in. And after that, I wanted to jump, but my sister was like, no, you will stay up. And I was like, I'm a swimmer too. She's like, no, you will get dizzy, you will die. And she didn't let me go to the water. But after that, I jumped with the other side. Yeah, it was hard, but it was a little bit funny in the boat too. It was really hard, like, that I had to do a funny faces for the kid on the boat. We stayed 3 hours and a half after that we arrived. The last, like, half an hour, I couldn't swim anymore. So I was catching the rope of the boat. My life was just passing through my eyes. Yeah, this is what is happening. Swimming, for me, it's a passion, my life. Like, everything you can't explain, you know? It's from your deep down in your heart. I have it in my heart, and I want to achieve something in it, you know. My dream is a gold medal in the Olympics.
Keep an eye out for Yusra and the entire Olympic refugee team as the games kick off next week in Brazil. That's our show for this week. Next week, I will be on vacation, and Molly Wood is filling in with a show dedicated to the Olympics. Also, over the next couple of weeks, we want to keep hearing your stories about how you balance your personal time with your work time, or don't. Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, just search for Marketplace Business News, or you can call us 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan, Eliza Mills, and Haley Hirschman. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Chris Clark is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. And Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.